Morning, guys.
Morning. Everybody seems to be fired up this morning. There's a lot of chatter going on. Well, welcome to the Board of Public Works. We're going to get started. This is an away game for me, staying out of the State House, but it's always great to join my colleagues here on their home turf at the Lewis Goldstein building. You know, as Louis used to say, may the good Lord bless you all real good. But we're here today for our semi-annual bond sale. And I know that the treasurer and her staff have been working really hard to make sure that today's sale is a success. And last month, all three rating agencies reaffirmed Maryland's AAA bond rating. Maryland is one of only 13 states in America to receive this coveted ranking. And I think that our AAA rating is the result of all of us working together in a bipartisan manner and acting as prudent stewards of the taxpayers' money. All three rating agencies noted our state's sound fiscal policy, strong financial controls, and prudent debt management. And I want to especially applaud my colleagues, Treasurer Kopp and Comptroller Franchot, and their staffs for all of their tremendous work. And I want to thank them for their collaboration with our team, especially Budget Secretary David Brinkley and his staff. And we could not have received this AAA bond rating without all of us working together. So let's please give all of them a big round of applause. I also want to give a quick shout-out to Secretary Brinkley and Secretary Leahy and their teams at the Departments of Budget and Management and Information Technology for the launch of the Maryland Transparency Portal. This new website allows Maryland taxpayers to become better informed about the details of the state budget with a user-friendly interface. And it's helping us to continue to make state government more accessible, more transparent, and more convenient for taxpayers. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues for some opening comments, and I'll start with you, Mr. Comptroller.
Thank you, Governor, and couldn't agree with you more about the strong economic bones of the state of Maryland and the good fiscal leadership that you and the Treasurer, I, and others in the legislature from time to time, that's the legislature, exert the right kind of fiscal oversight, and I think it's important for the citizens to realize that that there's a lot of oversight and accountability that doesn't get publicized that goes into getting a AAA bond rating. I'd also like to mention that we have the Mount Hebron High School economics team that the Governor and Treasurer and I just met with. This is a small group of tremendously competent students. At the National Economics Challenge, they won in an unprecedented fashion both the upper and lower level of this national competition. They then went over to St. Petersburg and won, I believe, the gold medal for best in economics. I think that was Mr. Curry and Mr. Krishna. So these victories, these young people are standing in the back. They know more about economics than I'll ever know. But they're, oh, good. Here they are coming all up. Yeah. I want to give a special note of thanks to their and recognition to Mr. Van Prime. If he could come up, he's the champion. And the Van, what do you teach up there?
I teach AP Micro and Macroeconomics and AP European History.
Okay, these are the best of the best right here. Thank you guys very much. You don't have to stand up there for the whole meeting.
We may call on you if we have some tough questions. So.
Yeah.
Thank you. Congratulations.
Go back and be comfortable. I did want to just On another point, I saw that the Baltimore City Teachers Union is seeking donated fans up in Baltimore. Obviously, we have tropical temperatures right now that may extend into the beginning of the school year, so the Teachers Union is asking the public to donate fans. Okay, here's a statement I put up on social media. Quote, it is beyond disgusting that in this, the wealthiest state and the wealthiest nation on earth, teachers have to resort to doing this, asking the public to donate fans, in order to protect themselves and their kids from the brutal heat. That's exactly why I've been fighting the education bureaucracy in our state for nearly 10 years to install portable air conditioning units in the classrooms of Baltimore City and Baltimore County. It's why Governor Hogan made this his fight as well as soon as he took office, even in the face of inexplicable retaliation from the Annapolis machine, which put into the conference committee report 1 year a specific prohibition on spending any state dollars for portable air conditioning units. Think of that. And they're joined by the Baltimore Sun editorial page. If anybody knows that group, give them a hats off for creating and extending this situation of our students roasting in hot, humid weather, which will occur inevitably come the start of the school year. I'm going to keep applying pressure on these school systems to get these schools fixed so that children have cool classrooms in the hot months and warm classrooms in the cold months. It has nothing to do whatsoever with resources. It has everything to do with competence, compassion, and common sense. Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Madam Treasurer.
Thank you, Governor. I just wanted to make sure everybody understood that the bond sale results will be in at 11 o'clock. We will be watching them then and signing them then, and meanwhile hope to get the rest of the Board of Public Works agenda through. I just want to add my thanks to the staffs of all of the agencies that have worked together on this. I think it's going to be a great sale, and it could never have been done. You'll notice most of the treasurer's office is off somewhere else counting numbers and working with the FAs, but it couldn't be done without all of the agencies that have been working together on this for 6 months now. And we hope it's a great sale because it helps fund more than anything the schools and higher education buildings in this state, which leads me to another point. The governor was talking, and I believe absolutely correctly, thanking and praising the strong financial governance of this state, both the legislature, the executive, and the counties. But in addition, the rating agencies always cite the educational level, the schools, and the great workforce we have in Maryland, the heart of Maryland. So it's a combination both of the substance of Maryland and then of the formal government. I think that we will see the results of all this in an hour, and the people will benefit. So I thank you. I know you all are going off after this to Ocean City.
Yep.
and Mako, and I hope you'll carry my greetings with you. I can't make it this year. One of the first times in about
My swim trunks packed.
Yes. and your crab hammered.
Yes, my crab hammered.
Well, thank you, Madam Treasurer.
But Governor, I see the Secretary of Budget here, and I just want to point out that since we last met, the Secretary sent out a letter to all the cabinet, and I assume all the agencies also, saying that the policy of the state has changed and that the default position for the state fleet will be electric-based cars, which includes hybrids. and that while, of course, there are some instances in which the state fleet cannot use at this point until it's more fully developed the electric fleet, but the agencies will have to send to him an explanation of why they can't use them, because the default is to go green. And for that, I want to thank you. I hope the Board of Public Works will be following up and seeing how this great policy is actually implemented on the ground and on the roads. But we stand ready to help in any way we can. I thank you.
Thank you for that, Madam Treasurer. The only impediment we see at this point is what the market can produce so that we can use...
And the infrastructure.
Right, and the infrastructure. So. Right.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Treasurer. Let's get started with the Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor. Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 20 items on the Secretary's agenda. We have 6 reports of emergency procurements. Item 20 is the bond sale, so we will hold that one back until the Treasurer calls that one up. We are prepared on the other 19 items and the emergency reports if you have any questions.
Questions on the Secretary's agenda?
Item 8.
Item 8 is the Housing Department, and this is a project in Landis and Sturgis County.
Oh, that's DDM? Yeah. What are we on right now?
Oh, I'm sorry. Secretary.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
Okay. Mr. Manley, can I have your seat? All right.
So no questions on the Secretary?
No, I like that one.
Move approval.
I'd just like to point out, it's not a question, but to the Secretary of Natural Resources, there are several items. But one particularly, the coastal resiliency projects, of which there are several, Secretary's item number 10, where we actually see the work of the Coast Smart Council and coastal resiliency not only in action, and we know that it's been in action, but spelled out here so everybody can see what is happening. I congratulate you. These are really, really good projects.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Want to say anything about it, but I recommend otherwise everybody look at it. It's the beginning of a great program. And I hope, Governor, I won't say this again, but there are a number of items like that and MDE items and, in fact, a couple from the university where they take the time to point out in the item how it relates to our state's climate change goals and greenhouse gas mitigation goals. And I thank you.
And we thank you for constantly keeping us on track.
I'm going
to remind you. Appreciate it. So there is a motion to approve the Secretary's agenda. Is there a second?
Second. You
made the motion. So 3-0. And we're going to move on to the DNR real property agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. And Madam Treasurer, thank you again for that nice highlight of our coastal resiliency program. We certainly appreciate the Governor's full funding of all of those finances and funding programs in our budget, which allows us to do those great projects. Today, we have 8 items on our real property agenda for which we are seeking approval, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions on DNR? Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0 on DNR. Move on to DBM.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. For the record, I'm David Brinkley, the Secretary of the Department of Budget and Management. We brought 8 items for your consideration. I'm withdrawing item 3S, leaving 7 for your voting. I've represented here to address the questions that you may have.
Questions?
Yes, this is item 8. I'd like to.
Calling up David McGlone, yes. Deputy Secretary of Department of Labor. And possibly Mike Hopkins, if he's here, he's executive director of the Racing Commission.
I think we're trying to move the DBM
people
right then. Fine. I think the Racing Commission is part of the Man,
Sheila is not messing around. Glad I wasn't late.
Yeah. Reminded me of the Army.
Good morning, Governor. David McGlone, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Labor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So
So we're looking at a six-month extension of a contract with Truesdale Labs for equine blood testing and analysis at the Racing Commission regulated racetracks. For the moment, I'm going to put aside the fact that this is an extension of a contract. The incumbent is held since 2014 because I recall a very troubling article I saw in The Sun on June 19th recently. The headline reads, Maryland Horse Racing Regulators Ignored Rules as They Dispensed State Money to Track Owners. Despite respectable attempts to deflect blame, it's quite clear that the Maryland Racing Commission didn't do its due diligence and in most cases directly violated the law and applicable regulations when it awarded nearly $22 million from the racetrack facility renewal account to the Stronach Group. Instead of carefully reviewing capital improvement plans and closely monitoring how the millions of dollars were spent, Maryland Racing Commission, in essence, served as a rubber stamp and signed blank checks to reimburse the Stronach Group for capital improvements that weren't reviewed or approved by the commission, as the laws and regulations require. The commission, for example, didn't approve a capital plan for 2018, yet the commission reimbursed $6.8 million in taxpayers' money to the Stronach Group. In the rare instance in which the commission did approve a capital improvement plan, in this case, and I quote, for, quote, significant investments in the rebuilding of Pimlico Racetrack, Racecourse, end quote, the Baltimore Sun's investigation found that the Stronach Group spent most of the state funds at the Laurel Park Racecourse, not at Pimlico. This is just completely unacceptable. I'm not suggesting corruption is involved here, but at the very least, this constitutes a dereliction of duty. We find ourselves in a situation where we're allowing Canadian billionaires to use the public taxpayers' account as their credit card without having to follow the laws and regulations that govern that fund. So this incident, this failure of a government commission to exercise its fiduciary responsibilities, serves as yet another glaring example of the fact that slots have not delivered the promises that were sold to Maryland taxpayers. We were told an influx of cash would go towards our schools. That was complete fiction until the lockbox bill was passed last year. We were told that portions of the proceeds would go to capital improvements to Pimlico, which we all support. I think, as this article underscores, given the unsafe conditions of Pimlico, that is yet another promise unfulfilled. We're told we'd see a steady stream of cash that could fix our structural deficit. That hasn't happened either. I want to salute Doug Donovan and all the journalists at The Sun who were involved in this fact-finding investigation, because had it not been for the reporting, this pattern of reckless behavior and governance would have continued. So let me just go back to the item that is before us for a second and talk about this extension. Last month, a single bid contract from the Racing Commission with this vendor was pulled from the agenda. According to the background materials, this extension is requested so the Racing Commission can make a proper assessment of whether to reissue the solicitation utilizing a different procurement method. I sincerely hope that whatever method is decided upon, it results in more bid competition, as I find it hard to believe that only one vendor in the entire country is able to submit an acceptable bid for these services. So I'm voting for the six-month extension, but I have some big concerns.
I can understand that, Mr. Controller. And one of the things we are concerned about is getting fair competition on this contract. We want to make sure that some of the labs that are out there will honor a Maryland contract, which some of them are university labs, which they don't. They're connected with a different state. They don't want to sign the Maryland contract. So we're the procurement method we're going to use is going to make sure that we understand that up front so we get all the available vendors that we can to understand what the Maryland contract looks like and will they be able to sign that contract and bring forth a proper and equitable bid for the board to consider next time out.
And the current contract is just about to expire, so we need
right.
an extension in order to do the study to take a look at what we're going to do on the longer-term contract.
Exactly.
Governor, I support the extension, but I didn't quite hear from you what new, different type of procurement system you're going
to
use.
Well, we want to make sure that in the invite the bidders in the pre-proposal conference to make sure that they can understand the
So you can use the sealed proposal again, just the way you did before.
Right. So to make sure that in the pre-proposal they all understand the nature of the contract.
So it's the same procurement method. It's just that you're reaching out more?
make sure that the outreach is more extensive to all the potential labs out there, and that they understand the ramifications of the Maryland contract, so that we can.
You didn't extend it to all the potential labs.
We didn't invite them all into the. We invited them in, but we didn't follow up to make sure they were able to attend the pre-proposal contract pre-proposal meeting.
And you think that's what made the difference?
We think their lack of understanding of the contract made a difference.
Once they saw the Maryland contract. After the fact, they were no longer interested in bidding. Is that what you're saying?
At least one of them, we know that was the case. Mm-hmm.
And was there something particular to the contract that they didn't want to deal with?
Well, they were connected with a different state government, so they knew that they couldn't sign another state's contract with some of the provisions that were in there.
How will that change?
Well, we want to make sure that we get more of these labs, let them know that this is what the contract looks like, to make sure that at least they'll be able to put a bid in with these contract clauses in there. But they're well versed in that beforehand, before they put their proposal in.
So this proposed 6-month extension, you believe, gives us all time to take a look at the entire process and how we might be able to do a better job?
Yes, sir.
Or we're just going to go back and do the same thing we did before?
No, we're going to make. Take our time to make sure we do this with a little more due diligence, to make sure that all the vendors are aware of the full contract proposals and the stipulations. And then they can put in their bid accordingly.
Okay.
And presumably by the time you're back, the commission will have had its postponed meeting, and we'll see what progress has been made on the racetrack.
Oh, I'm sure that's going to be happening this fall, yes.
We look forward to seeing that.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you very much. See you in 6 months, I guess.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions on the DBM agenda?
I have a question, since we have a couple minutes, and it's on the withdrawn item, but it's a higher level question than three. And that is, when price differences over a total project, a long-term project, seem to us relatively small, how do we factor in, and I should be asking my staff this, but you're here, how do we factor in the impact on our economy or employment in Maryland?
I'll have to, since we pulled the item, we didn't have people.
Okay, this is a generic, maybe.
We'll make sure staff gets on top of that. Go ahead, Jamie.
The procurement advisor for the board could give you. We adopted that regulation about 15 years ago, the economic benefits regulation, and yeah. I think Mr. Nall can explain.
But
to
I
you
don't
how
know what
it is.
There's a difference in price. There's no question, but it seems relatively small to me as a layman.
For the record, Gabe Nall, procurement advisor for the board. In a procurement like this, a competitive sale proposal procurement, you have a technical proposal and a financial proposal.
Yes.
In the technical proposal, there is one of the factors to be considered is economic benefits to the state.
In the technical
provision. So that would impact their technical ranking. Now, when they have, a higher technical financial price, when you're determining what is the best value to the state, you need to weigh their technical ranking versus their financial ranking. Now, that comes into the analysis as well, what price difference there is, and does that outweigh the difference in technical quality?
And that's just a gut feeling.
Well, you typically have a committee, an evaluation committee that discusses the proposals, all the proposals received, and the ranks them. And they are the ones that usually reach a consensus as to what they determine to be the best value to the state. And if there is a significant difference in price, typically you would go through more. You may say, well, that can rank a bit lower in the overall consensus. But in this circumstance, we're looking at in this item, and of course, I know it's been withdrawn, and the agency wishes to discuss it at a later agenda. It seemed like some of the proposals, they were similar in price. They were very close in price. And so one of the questions we've asked the agency to respond to is, how did they take into account economic benefits of the state?
Okay.
So we'll hear more about that.
Thank you. We'll look forward to it.
Great. Is there a motion on the DBM agenda?
Move approval.
Second.
3-0. Move on to the university system.
Good morning. Joe Evans, representing the university system of Maryland. We have 5 items on the agenda. Here to answer the questions.
Questions for the university system?
Item 5, RP.
We have Nevi Sursu, who is the Vice President for Capital Planning and campus operations from UP.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Just for the record, what is your name?
Sure. My name is Neb Sursu. I'm the Vice President for Campus Planning and Campus Operations.
Thank you. Governor and Treasurer, we're being asked today to declare a property recently acquired by the state located in East Baltimore as a surplus in anticipation of its transfer to the U.S. Postal Service. This is being done to set up an exchange of properties with the Postal Service that will ultimately yield a prime parcel of real estate for the University of Baltimore. Earlier stages of this exchange have been before this board numerous times, and I think without fail we have remarked upon the odd nature of this arrangement in which the state is constructing a vehicle maintenance facility for the U.S. Postal Service. While this is certainly an unusual arrangement, I know the property exchange was negotiated fiercely by none other than Maryland's former senior senator, Barbara Mikulski, who remains a top priority for the university, which, by the way, has exemplary leadership with former Mayor Schmoke. And I think the university has seen a number of exciting capital improvements, including the new library expansion. So with Amtrak committing to invest $90 million in the nearby Penn Station, which is just a stone's throw away, UB is on the verge of acquiring what I think is a lot of potentially very valuable property for the university campus. I was wondering if you could give us an indication as to what this property will be used for, academic purposes, housing, offices.
Sure. Thank you so much for starting by noting that the university's leadership is strong and that the properties around our campus are growing in value. I think with Penn Station development underway and a number of other smaller developments happening in Midtown, Station North neighborhood, we're excited about the prospect of acquiring this property. This was a journey that started 10 years ago, so we certainly didn't anticipate it being as valuable as it is today. I think for us at this point, the first step in our process will be to demolish the existing structure and prepare the site for development. While that work is underway, our intent is to meet with our internal community and external stakeholders to talk through what type of development would bring the amenities and a revenue stream for the institution. So it's a process we haven't initiated yet. I think it will not be necessarily driven by student housing or academic space because that isn't a need for our campus at this point. But I think with all of the developments that's happening around us, most of it tends to be types of developments that bring retail and housing to the neighborhood, and I think that's probably going to be part of the mix. But we just started the journey, so we haven't developed a program at this point.
How about partnering with a state agency?
I think we're open to all types of discussions. Again, for us, the driver is to make sure that it is a development that continues the progress that's been happening in the neighborhood and continues to grow the city.
And how large is the acquisition?
The parcel is 2.5 acres.
And am I right? It's a stone's throw away from Penn Station?
Yes, you are right. Yes, you are right. It's essentially, you know, a block away.
As the plans develop, if you could let us know what direction you're headed in.
We certainly will.
Not that I don't have a state agency that's looking for space up in Baltimore, but I'll leave that to the higher level of command. Congratulations. I think this is an odd arrangement, but one that's a positive for the state.
Sure. And on behalf of the university, thank you so much for all the support we've received from the work of us today.
Thank you.
Could I just ask one more question? You mentioned the community, but I assume you're working with the city also.
Correct.
On this prime.
Oh, absolutely. The city's been supportive of our efforts, and the Baltimore Development Corporation has assisted us in the process, so they'll be at the table as well.
An interesting time, as the comptroller pointed out, for Kurt Schmoke to be leading the effort to reinvigorate Station North.
Good. Absolutely. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions on the university system?
Move approval.
Second. Go. 3-0.
Thank you.
Move on to Department of Information Technology.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. My name is Stephen Colby, the Assistant Secretary for the Department of Information Technology and for Secretary Leahy. Today we have 13 items on the agenda. Two are supplemental. Agency representatives are here to answer any questions you may have.
I'd like to bring up item 8IT MOT.
8IT, that's the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services.
Yeah, I just want to talk about this item. I really don't have questions, but I just want to request that the board approve this contract.
Secretary.
Oh, great. Well, wonderful. So I didn't see the secretary here. We're happy to have him come up and talk with us for a second. Good morning, Mr. Secretary. I think this may be the first time we've had you with the Board of Public Works since you came in. In your new role?
I believe this is number five.
Oh, number five, okay.
Maybe
I was missing. Well, welcome. I think this contract is going to significantly enhance our abilities to contact victims of crime in Maryland about the status of the offenders who have damaged them and their lives and committed crimes against them or their loved ones. In 2000, we were one of the first states in the nation to provide for this victim identification and notification every day or VINE system. And under this operation, the state has the capability to contact registered crime victims so that they can track their offenders every step of the way through the criminal justice system. And the service allows victims to monitor the offender's incarceration status, court dates, parole and probation compliance, sex offender registration, and the status of protective orders that they've filed for their own safety. These enhancements, I believe, will provide new state-of-the-art tools so that the victims can learn perpetrator status via phone, internet, mobile device, and a range of languages. And the contract that we have before us today sends a clear message that protecting the victims of crime will remain a top priority for us. Anything you want to add about that?
Yes, sir. Well, we're pleased to bring this before the Board of Public Works, and as you noted, a significant public safety enhancement. We've been able to identify some grant funding and then funding within the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services to get this platform in place. I think this single point of registration for victims of crime within the system is an incredible enhancement, and will also lay the groundwork for pretrial applications,
right,
which we have discussed in our state. So we are pleased to bring it forward. It will be a one-year implementation, and when we are done, we will be the 24th state to have it fully online.
Great. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank While you. You're up here, is there another contract about telephone?
Yes.
Communication. You're in support of that, and
I'm in absolute support of that contract. It's a contract for the telecommunication systems for the inmate population and their families. It's a significant contract for us that represents the savings to the families and the population. It is a revenue account to the state and the cost to the state or the department. So I'm fully supportive of that contract as well.
Excellent.
Thank you very much, Secretary. Any other questions on information technology?
Yes, I have item 11, if I could.
Councilor, that's the item 11. It's, okay. I'll be able to answer any questions.
Okay. So this is $1.4 million from the State Board of Elections for IT security consulting services.
Yeah, Councilor, I'm so sorry. You might be referring to item 10 for the Board of Elections.
That's 9.
Item nine.
Thank you. Of course. Okay, we'll get it straight. Board of Elections.
Do it 9IT.
Okay, thank you. That's Administrator Linda Lamont.
Oh, there is one.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, 9, 10.
We have two items from the election.
9 and 10.
And 10.
Yeah. Right.
The first is the post-election audit, and the second is to buy more equipment for the voting system. Hi, for the record, Linda Lamone, Administrator of Elections. Good morning.
Yes, thank you, Madam Administrator. Yeah, no, thank you for being here. Item 11.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. I know you and your team have been hard at work ensuring our election systems are safe from potential cyber attacks. And this is a contract for $1.4 million. I think it's a series of task orders that are coming before the board about this interference from hostile actors who want to compromise the integrity of our election system. So Special Counsel Mueller apparently said recently Russians massively intervened in 2016. They're prepared to do so again. in voting that is set to begin America 8 months from now. So the leaders in Washington seem to be paralyzed a little bit right now as far as the urgent threat that Russia continues to pose to our political process. I wonder to what extent you're able to say publicly what you're doing as a, what we're doing as a state to safeguard the integrity of the ballot box. I note that this contract is specifically for a vendor to provide strategic leadership, quote unquote, for securing systems and data. Where do we stand, and what can you say about this ongoing situation?
Well, unfortunately, it is ongoing, and that's one of the reasons why we need more expertise in our office, specifically dedicated to addressing the constantly emerging issues with security generally, and particularly in the area of elections. We've got staff that is able to do the everyday protection stuff, running the scans and monitoring and stuff, but we don't have any expertise for looking forward and planning strategically as to where we need to be. And this is sort of the trend around the country where the folks that run elections are using the federal money that was allotted last year, I believe, to the states, using that money to enhance their security footprint in their offices. And while I feel fairly comfortable today saying to you everything is fine, I can't really, not being a security expert either, I can't really say with confidence that in the future we won't be comfortable. So I think it's really, really important for us to move forward with this. And we use all the services provided by the Department of Homeland Security. They have, I think, 8 or 9 of them. And one of them is ongoing. We get a weekly report. They're scanning. We have what's called the Albert sensor installed. And that's from one of the other fingers of the Department of Homeland Security that monitors all our traffic as well. The data center, everything there is monitored not only by my staff but by a security firm that we've hired to do so, and they report any suspicious activity. Of course, each of the systems have different risks, so we have different mitigation strategies for each of them. I can't say in detail what they are, but I can tell you that we work very diligently every day to make sure everything is safe. And we never connect the voting system to the internet. So there's an air gap between it and anything that talks to the internet. And we do have paper ballots. So.
No, what was that last phrase?
We do have paper ballots.
Yeah, yes. That's music to most people's ears, that there is a paper trail now.
Yes.
Governor, thank you, and Madam Treasurer, for that. And
thank you.
Madam Administrator, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions on Do It?
I have got 4 items.
Yeah. I don't think there's any questions.
No, and I'm sorry, there was confusion with your subpart of another thing. Item 12, if I could. Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is important. This is item 12. This item contains a request to award a single bid contract for services to install telephone equipment in a new location of the Department of Education's Disability Determination Services. This contract is before the board as a master contract task award, order award. I want to thank again the governor and the treasurer for joining me in bringing these types of contracts to the board. Here, previously, they had not come back before us. But it actually has increased my concern about the need for transparency because according to my notes, 108 task order contracts this board has reviewed today. 29 have been single bids, amounting collectively to more than $20.4 million in single bid contracts. I'm pleased to say that single bids are at a record low right now, but now with this new package of proposals that are going to be coming before us with the task orders, I think we need to pay some attention to the fact that from your approved list, you're apparently awarding single bid contracts. And I thought that was one of the solutions to the single bid situation that was going to come from these, from this system that you have of master contract pre-approved people. According to my background notes, of the five companies eligible to bid on this contract under the master contract, only one is currently providing these telephone installation services. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
So it sounds like the company recommended for contract award, frankly, was bidding against itself. That being the case, I have a hard time seeing how anyone, for that matter, taxpayers or myself, could possibly be assured that we're getting the best deal for their money with this contract. You know, I'm looking at the particular master contract. We noted the board awarded a single bid task order for $1.3 million to the same vendor in question here back in April. So if there's only one company on the master contract that can perform the services, why not, I guess, bid the contract out through traditional procurement process, as the treasurer alluded to, and open the bidding up to the marketplace?
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. That's something that we can certainly do in the future. The you're correct in that the master contract has four master contracts authorized to provide sales support and repair of the equipment. The phone system that we've standardized on, NEC, has been in place for 8 years. And the vendor that is responding, it's because of the portfolio of vendors that are available. They have the good fortune of having a stronger overall service offering and price than the other bidders. And over a series of solicitations that have been awarded under this contract in the past, the other bidders have ceased to respond because in the past they have not provided the most advantageous proposal for the state. So whilst I certainly appreciate and agree with what you are saying about the single bid, I would only note to the board that that the history proves out that among the pool of contractors in the secondary competition, the vendor has a track record of providing the best price in comparison to the other offers historically. So,
but what are you going to do to reduce the number of single bids that seem to naturally happen from the vehicle of the master contract?
Your suggestion seems like the most straightforward way to approach addressing single bid.
Okay.
Are there, in fact, other companies, the two PBX, that aren't in the master contract?
Yes. Yes.
Why aren't they? Did they not seek to be in the master contract?
There were the four offerers that responded. I think that it's a matter of what the marketplace bore at the time that the solicitation was offered. I can certainly get you the more detail, Madam Treasurer, if you would like,
I just don't quite understand why. And the master contract lists are replenished periodically. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
Yes, because we've seen them. So why aren't there more PBX? Is it an old technology why aren't they?
That's a very good question. NEC has a list of approved partners. So phone systems have the underlying technology requires certain expertise. So an NEC phone system can be supported only with a certain labor pool that's competent to support that technology, as opposed to, say, another company. So NEC would have a list of partners, if you will.
But only one partner that's on the master contract list?
There's four.
Who do this? Who do the PBX?
There are four companies that are able to provide the service. I think to the comptroller's question, if that's still what we're discussing, the one vendor that was awarded
were the only bidder in this case. They were the only bidders because they the other vendors didn't bid, and we our observation is that the other bidders did not bid because they did not provide, they in the past have not succeeded in receiving any awards, so they have stopped bidding.
Any other questions?
So you're going to fix this somehow.
Just to come fully, yes. Like I said, I think that your suggestion about the straightforward approach to addressing it is either to bid it on the open market, not for a secondary competition, or to increase the pool of vendors, Madam Treasurer, as I think you were suggesting. That's another approach. But we will definitely address this so that, you know, we don't see additional single bids. I know that's something that the board does not prefers not to see. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Governor.
Great. Thank you. Is there a motion on the do it?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0.
Thank you.
Now 11 o'clock, so I think we should probably break at this point to do the bond sale and hold off on the next couple of items.
You have probably noted that there are a lot of sort of flashing indicators in the global economy, which are not great. But typically that means the inverse is happening in the bond market. So we had a very successful sale this morning. We sold $500 million in tax-exempt bonds in two bidding groups and then another $50 million in taxable bonds. For the first bidding group, we got a 6 of 113 for the low here from Morgan Stanley, which included $67 million in premium. For the bidding group two, the low was Bank of America with a 198 tick. Those were longer maturities, which is why the tick is higher there, and about $30 million in premium for that. And finally, for the taxable, we had another 7 bids with Raymond James and Associates with the low tick. So those were our results. And Treasurer, if you want to.
That's very good.
Thanks. I think there should be cheers. That's after all that.
Maryland is a great investment.
Did you run the totals on all the premiums on the portal?
Yeah, so we got a total gross premium of $99,407,000.
We couldn't get to 100 nights.
We couldn't. we'll work harder next time.
That's very good. And obviously what it means is we will be able to build the schools and other public facilities that are so seriously needed at a lower price than the taxpayers would otherwise have to pay.
Okay.
And that's very good. It's too bad about our economy and the market, but it does show that you don't have to just invest in gold in tough times. You can invest in Maryland, too.
Maryland is like gold to me.
It is. So,
can we double the amount?
Well, that's what I...
I mean, really, that is
yeah,
just...
Really.
But what is the first tranche? How long was that...
So that has maturity is going through 2029, so 10 years is the longest maturity.
Pretty amazing.
So, Governor, in order to essentially sanctify this, I would move that the board adopt the resolutions before us today concerning the state and local facilities loan of 2019, second series. In particular, I move that the board ratify and approve the preliminary offer official statement, POS, dated August 7, 2019, the summary notice of sale for the 2019 second series bonds published in the bond buyer on August 2, 2019, and the resolutions adopted by the board on July 24th, 2019 with respect to the bonds, and would ask for a second and a vote on those motions.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Secondly, I would move that Morgan Stanley and Company LLC be declared the successful bidder for Group 1 of the Second Series A tax-exempt bonds in the aggregate principal amount of $248,675,000, subject to resizing as provided in the official notice of sale, with a net premium of $67,466,506.13. I love those. And a true interest cost of 1.133797%.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. And I further move that the first group of the second series bond, A bonds, be issued in the amounts and maturities of the interest rates and prices set forth in the successful bid for the bonds, and ask for a second for that.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor? Aye.
You have to do this, dot every I, cross every T. I move that the Bank of America Merrill Lynch be declared the successful bidder for Group 2 of the Second Series A tax-exempt bonds in the aggregate principal amount of $251,325,000, subject to resizing as provided in the OS, with debt premium of $31,940,852.20. And a true interest cost of 1.984873%, and further move that the second group of the second series A bonds be issued in the amounts and maturities and at the interest rates and prices set forth in the successful bid for the bonds. I would ask for a second.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. And four, I would move that Raymond James and Associates be declared the successful bidder for the second series B taxable bonds in the aggregate principal amount of $50,000, subject to resizing as provided in the OS, with a true interest cost of 1.609546%, and further move that the second series B bonds be issued in the amounts and maturities and at the interest rates and prices set forth in the successful bid of the bonds, and ask for a second and a vote on the second series. 50 million, sorry. 50 million, not 50,000.
Sounds like a lot more.
We can ask the fellows from Hebron.
Yeah, we shouldn't let those kids go.
More. And ask for a second and a vote on the second.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. And finally, move that the board authorize and approve the issuance of the final official statement for the bonds. for a second.
Second?
Second.
All those in favor? Aye.
Aye. Governor, congratulations.
Congratulations. Wonderful job.
Thank you to Kristen Lund and his great staff.
Bernadette, what is the lowest interest rate we've ever gotten?
This is the second lowest. The lowest we got was, I think, was like 1.11. It was in 2016, July 2016. So this is the second lowest we've ever had.
That's very good. And almost $100
million. Maybe
that's fine. It's great to get a couple bucks.
Women's match with pockets. Sorry.
Very good. Well, congratulations again to the treasurer and her staff and to everybody in both the comptroller's office, the budget, all the other departments, everybody who worked to help make this happen. It really is a terrific accomplishment.
Bernadette Bennett, the most outstanding public servant in the state of Maryland.
There you go, Bernadette. Thank you. Good. So we'll get back to our agenda. We're moving on to the Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Treasurer Kopp, Governor Hogan, Controller Franco. For the record, my name is R. Earl Lewis, Jr., Deputy Secretary with the Maryland Department of Transportation. The Maryland Department of Transportation has presented 12 items for approval this morning, and I have representatives here to speak on any item you have questions.
Any questions on transportation? Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Is there a second? 3-0 on transportation. We're going to move on to the Department of General Services.
Good morning, Governor. I'm Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Ellington Churchill, Secretary for the Department of General Services. The Department has 21 items on our agenda today. We are withdrawing 10 to 16, leaving 20 for your approval. We have representation to answer any questions you may have at this time.
Thank you. Any questions on DGS?
Yes. Item 17.
Item 17 is the CGL. Shirley Kennedy, Director of... 17 is a tenant. It's MBA. And Kim White.
Terrific. Thank you. I understand this is an item that... MVA is going to place two office trailers in the parking lot of the shopping center where the Parkville branch MVA office is. It's needed to ensure that the number of customers entering the MVA facility do not exceed the capacity, and apparently the demand is being governed by the new licenses that are required. And I know that we rank number one in the country, I believe, Governor, under your leadership, and Administrator, is it Nizer?
Yep.
Yeah. Good job. You've made great strides in improving customer service and efficiency. I salute the agency for that, especially with its ongoing efforts to ensure that every Maryland driver's license holder is compliant with the federal requirements in the Real ID Act. I'd like to just ask a question about the ongoing effort on Real ID. I know the agency has devoted considerable staffing and outreach and marketing. Could you just briefly summarize what Real ID is and why this federal law is causing such an issue in the states?
Certainly. For the record, my name is Christine Nizer. I'm the administrator of M.MBA, and Real ID was passed after the tragic events of 9/11. Essentially, the federal government wanted to ensure that when a state-issued driver's license or ID card was presented, that they could have confidence that the individual identity had been verified appropriately. So various security standards were put in place from the documentation that an individual had to present. Those documents have to be retained by us. We're required to do verification through various electronic systems. We passed a law, the state of Maryland passed a law back in 2011. We began scanning documents for our new customers in 2009. So we currently have on file documents required by the Federal Real ID Act for more than half of our customers. So we're really in good shape compared to most other states. In fact, some states only passed Real ID requirements within the last year or so. So we're much ahead of that. In terms of having the right card, which the card has to have the star on it, and you have to have documents on file, you have to have both of those requirements. Just over 2 million of Maryland residents have one of those. So again, we're making really good progress. We continue aggressive outreach efforts, both with direct mail, email. We've attended about 90 community events since April, and we're going to continue to do that and be out. I really believe that personal interaction with somebody is the best way to explain the requirements. It's a little complex, and unfortunately, quick sound bites don't exactly tell the customer everything they need. So, yes, we've added 100 employees. In June, we saw 65,000 customers with appointments. You know, the treasurer remarked at one of the last meetings about the great appointment she had at our Annapolis branch office. And what I'm most proud of is the fact that in spite of the increased volume that we're seeing, customers continue to give our employees 98% satisfaction with customer service. And so it tells me our employees are doing a great job with that. And certainly Governor Hogan has made that a priority in terms of the customer service commitment. And we take that very seriously at M.MB.
Excellent. What is the deadline for the federal law?
It's October of 2020.
And how confident are you that we're going to be able to take care of all of the folks that need to be verified?
I feel very confident that we have the resources and the capabilities to do that. Just at the Parkville location, which we're here about today, since May 28th when we opened through the beginning of the week, we served 18,000 customers there. They had an average wait time of 7 minutes, so you know, a good experience for those customers. And we've also opened a facility in Columbia as well with the support of DGS. So we're trying to be creative and look outside the box, extending hours to make times more convenient. So I do feel like we've got the resources necessary. I will say that for certain customers who don't enter a federal facility or don't fly frequently, they may be able to wait until their expiration date. So that's why that education process is really important. We don't want to make a customer come in unnecessarily and pay for a new product when they might not need one. So that's why we want to make sure all the information is out there and the customer can make the best decision for themselves.
Well, that's great news. I see Delegate Ebersol there. I wonder, Governor, if you would agree to let Delegate Ebersol come up and say a word, because he has some legislation that he was talking about. It may be helpful, but yeah, Delegate, Eric, come on up here, if that's okay. And thank you for that summary, because it sounds like it's respecting everybody and responding to them and getting results for them, and that's a whole new reputation for MBA.
Customer service very seriously, and like I said, we've changed our whole approach to the point of making personal phone calls to people that are impacted. We have their phone number, we're actually calling them and making sure they're aware of the requirements, so we take that very seriously.
Before the delegate side, let me just say, first of all, that thank you for recognizing the work that she and her team are doing, because they are doing a great job under very trying circumstances. One of the things I was impressed with in going there was that the employees are so much happier, because instead of having people yelling at them because they've been waiting for hours, they're getting a 98% approval rating. So they're saying thank you, and they really appreciate it. And the employees are really enjoying the customer service as well as the customers are. Right.
What we realized early on is that employees, you know, want to be held to a high standard too. And so we premier customer service is our motto, and every employee throughout the agency knows what that means, knows what it looks like. We talk about it, we role play it, and so the employees have really gotten behind that and are excited about it, have tried, which maybe in the past there wasn't as much of that. You know, we don't allow the jokes about motor vehicle agencies and the kind of employees that they have. We don't tolerate that because we really do want to create that great experience for every customer. We know every customer in Maryland has to come see us, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be a great customer experience for them, and that's what we're dedicated to every day. And, you know, every story I hear that's not so great is an opportunity to make it better, and that's how I see it.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I did say this before, but I want to say it again to you, and thank you. When I went through this and got the updated Real ID, not only was the MVA very efficient, the people out on Harry Truman Boulevard, not only were they very efficient, but they were very pleasant. And the whole feeling in that whole large room was positive. It was really, it was different than, A, the image, but B, than sometimes it needs to be, the reality. And I just want to thank you. However you've done it, it really made a big difference and is a model for.
It is a team effort. I appreciate that, and I'll take that back. I know Matt is an employee.
Thank you.
Are you any good at fixing potholes?
Sorry, that is not my expertise.
We have other people do that.
Yeah. Other people doing that. Yeah, we've already repaved half the entire state highway system.
That's right.
I didn't mean to ask Delegate Ebersole. You may not want to say anything, well, but thank you for highlighting.
I would have to echo some of the things that you have said about the NBA. They've been put in a difficult situation, clearly. They've gotten different sets of instructions from the federal government, and they're trying to now meet the new set of instructions and under some pressure because the time constraints are tough. And Ms. Neiser has been spent time meeting with me and with Delegate Stein, the Vice Chair of Environment and Transportation, to talk to us about the problem, and they are doing yeoman's work of trying to wind their way through this. There are so many different categories of people they have right now. People like me who recently updated their licenses, and I'm fully compliant. People who updated their licenses when they had a different set of instructions have come back and become compliant. And people who have what we would call the old style licenses who should maybe come in but don't have to, depending on what they're looking for. And they're trying to make sure they notify everybody what's going on. We do have one category of people we're concerned about, and that's people who aren't compliant right now and may not know it, or may not be willing to come back in. Either they're defying their notifications or they're missing them. And we're concerned about the federal government wants those licenses confiscated in the event of a traffic stop. Those people, the NBA is asking the law enforcement to confiscate those licenses. Puts them in a bit of a situation. And we're working on some legislative fixes for that right now to try to take care of those folks. It's clearly not the NBA's intent to attract people here. They're trying to follow instructions, and as I say, I think they've been placed in a difficult situation. My experiences, and I do a lot of sort of anecdotal checking with people about their experiences at the offices, and so you guys have given me three or four more reports here of people who say if you go with a good attitude and you've tried to make an appointment, you're going to go fine. I personally was in and out in less than 20 minutes. So.
Right. So the deadline, are they confiscating licenses now, or is that going to be after the deadline?
So we're reaching out to customers now. It was when we started the process, it was slightly over a million customers. These are individuals who have the new license that has a star on it but don't have documents on file with us. So we started reaching out to them in December of last year. The first group, we're giving everybody 6 months. Obviously, we wouldn't want to notify everybody all at one time. The first group had a June deadline. We extended it to July. There's a very small number of those individuals who have not yet responded. We will continue notifying them that they need to respond. We have put an indicator on their driving record. However, they would not be pulled over for this. They have to be pulled over for driving infractions, so speeding, taillight out, some issue. And then at that point, the law enforcement officer would have that information. We have provided training. It's certainly the discretion of the law enforcement officer what action they take. They have educational material to provide to the driver about what they need to do. And all individuals have been successful, you know, in getting that license when they've been provided information.
Yeah, I can see taking someone's license away after somehow informing them, but taking it away out on the highways could be a bit of a problem.
So, and just to be clear, we've provided more than 6 notices by mail and email to these customers. Again, we've reached out by phone where we had phone numbers. We've done everything we possibly could to notify them of the requirement. If they were even trying to comply and unable to do it by the deadline, we've extended them. So we are doing everything we possibly can. There are just some individuals who have not responded at
this point,
but it's a very small number.
What's the estimate?
So the number is 8,000.
8,000 out of a million?
Out of 80,000. Yeah, that number might grow.
And the federal government is giving us instructions that they have to be revoked.
That's right. We provide quarterly reports to the federal government, and they are monitoring our compliance. We were the first state in the country to be recertified, and so obviously they felt comfortable with the current process we're using, and we just need to make sure that stays the case.
Thank you.
It's 8,000 out of that group.
They call them batches, right? They're a batch of people that they notify. Obviously, they couldn't notify everybody at once. It would cause a terrible rush. So they're doing it. As I say, really smartly, in a sort of rolling system to try to get everybody up by October 1 of 2020.
What's the next?
Not until November the next deadline is, and the good news is we're seeing a much higher rate of people coming in, so 20% of the people we notified with the November deadline have already come in and taken care of that. So, frankly, that is higher than our renewal rates. So, good news in terms of people responding to those notices.
Well, I'm a big fan of the governor's efficiency and customer service, but you might think about the first time they're pulled over for something else and they have a problem, but taking someone's license right there is may sound good when you pass the law, but it can be, in certain instances, really questionable. You might allow them to have one chance with just a civil ticket or something, and then if they don't show up and they're pulled over again, then you can confiscate it. But I'm just speaking up for people whose addresses may not be good or for whatever the reason is. I'm not trying to stop the enforcement of a federal law. I'm just suggesting, you know, as opposed to you sending a letter, someone with a uniform on standing there saying, I'm going to give you one chance, and after this you're going to have your license confiscated. That's a little softer than give me your license and you're going to have to call someone and figure out how to get your car off the highway.
And law enforcement does have that discretion to make the decision of whether or not they recall the license, and that's been clear. Just like they do in any traffic stop, I mean, they can determine whether they give you a warning.
Oh, so it's not a mandate that they confiscate.
No, I mean, it's on the driving record, like many things are. When people have insurance violations, we put tag pickup orders because they, you know, haven't paid insurance for a very long time, and it's a dangerous thing. Law enforcement picks up. So there's various administrative things we put on records that law enforcement takes action. This is just one more of those things.
Okay, so correct. It's discretion.
It's discretion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me
out. Any other questions on DGS?
No, move approval.
For a second? 3-0. That concludes the Board of Public Works. Some of you will see you at MECO.